It's Thursday, April 1st, and you can't get better than 100%. We start here. The road to herd immunity runs through teenagers. Well, a drug maker now says its vaccine works even better on teens than adults.
It was found to be 100% effective in the 12 to 15-year-old age group.
Meanwhile, another vaccine maker suffers a massive setback. We'll walk you through the headlines. If the Supreme Court tells you your case is madness, that's not a good sign, even if you're the NC2A.
This would allow the players to receive $6,000 a year, as if that were some exorbitant amount.
The justices might have just signaled that college sports will change forever. And how do you get a country to help you with trafficking when its president is allegedly part of the problem?
His goal was to, quote, stick cocaine up the nose of the gringos.
The bizarre accusations coming out of Central America. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Today, on April 1st, might be the weirdest day of the year to announce big, important news events. But this morning, several states are drastically expanding their eligibility for who can get a COVID vaccine.
At least 32 states are expanding vaccine access for everyone 16 and older by the president's May 1st deadline.
At this point, more than 150 million doses have gone into the arms of Americans. President Biden's goal is 200 million by the end of the month. Now, depending on the vaccine, some people need two before they're fully immunized. But about 30% of Americans have gotten at least some level of protection, which means the types of people getting COVID at this point has changed drastically.
What concerns me is the footage of what's happening in spring breakers.
In many ways, the new face of COVID-19 is a young person.
Spring breakers descending on beaches and bars in Florida, where the UK variant is accelerating.
Someone who's healthy, mobile, perhaps not even aware that they've been carrying this virus into a new town, a place where maybe vaccinations are still going slowly.
The TSA reported it screened an average of more than a million passengers a day since March 11th. So
that is the scenario that's keeping health officials up at night. And even if your state has opened up vaccinations to quote-unquote everyone, that might not cover some of these young people. Because so far, these vaccines have only been approved for people 16 or over. But yesterday,
we're going to begin with that encouraging breaking news in the fight against coronavirus.
One vaccine maker, Pfizer, announced we could be one big step closer to getting a crucial chunk of America vaccinated. I'm talking about the teenagers. ABC's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Jennifer Ashton, is here. Dr. Jen, what is this announcement from Pfizer?
Well, I think it's definitely encouraging news. You know, first, let's look at the medical clinical data in this age group. You know, it doesn't look, luckily, that children are at extreme risk of severe complications and death from COVID-19. While it does happen, it's much, much less common. But we do know that kids do get infected, and kids and teens can therefore transmit the virus to others.
12-year-old Caleb Chung doesn't know if he got the vaccine or a placebo, but he wanted to be a part of the trial.
Potentially helping other kids to feel safe and want to get the vaccine.
In terms of the clinical trial data, this is really good news. It was found to be 100% effective in the 12 to 15-year-old age group in clinical trials.
They're doing great right now. The first day after, they both had sore arms.
Well-tolerated, side effects similar to that seen in adults. And Pfizer has not yet released data on the specifics of these clinical trials in terms of were these variants, was it asymptomatic as well as symptomatic infection. But whenever you hear a vaccine in a what's called a bridging clinical trial, 100% effective,
right,
that's obviously really good news.
Right, exactly. And it's, you don't want to take a company at face value. Although when Pfizer came out a few weeks ago and said, look, we are seeing the transmission rates of our, not just the symptoms, but like we are not seeing this virus get spread among people with the Pfizer vaccine. We were like, well, let's wait for the CDC. Well, sure enough, this week the CDC came out and said we're seeing a lot of that duplicated in our real world testing of this as well. Like what Pfizer said a few weeks ago is holding true right now. So we'll see what this means for teens. If this does hold, Dr. Jen, what does that mean? It means what, teens get inoculated sooner? What?
Well, according to the CEO of Pfizer, they plan to submit this bridging clinical trial data in the 12 to 15-year-old age group in the next couple of weeks.
Now we've had tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of kids 16 and 17 who've gotten vaccinated already. We've had young adults get vaccinated. So this is not in being looked at in a vacuum. We have a lot of data on young people. This just adds to that data. So I think it's going to be enough for the FDA to expand its authorization.
If it gets emergency use authorization, then according to Pfizer, they would be prepared and expect slash hope to see children vaccinated before the start of next school year. So that would mean end of summer, which would be great.
What a big deal. Hey, I know we keep saying that cases are going up. That's very bad. But in some places like Michigan, it looks like they're leveling off. Hospitalizations are still going down, essentially. Deaths are still going down. So my question to you is, like, if the average person getting COVID used to be a 70-year-old with asthma, very, you know, much higher chance of death. Now there's lots of cases, but if it's a 25-year-old at the beach, I'm not trying to say COVID can't still kill people, Dr. Jen, but is there a chance that at some point this does look more like what happens with the flu? Like, it's around, it's bad, it can kill people, but it's not a massive emergency if those are the types of people getting it.
Well, two things to unpack there, Brad. First of all, you're right. If hospitalizations and deaths continue to decline, that is what we want to see. And second thing is that according to many infectious disease specialists and epidemiologists, they do think that years down the road, SARS-CoV-2 will be endemic instead of pandemic. So yes, basically what you're describing could be our future down the road. But right now, what we're seeing is likely vaccination metrics.
This isn't the fault of the folks in their 30s and 40s and 50s. Up until the last week or so, you couldn't get a vaccine. But you can get one now.
We were very effective in canvassing that elderly age group and protecting them. We're seeing the benefits of that with nursing home cases way, way down.
And we have to knock these infection rates now, because it is relatively young people gathering in crowds that is causing the hospitals to start to fill up.
And now that ripple effect needs to trickle down to people in their 50s, 40s, 30s, and 20s.
Right. And last question, and I know this is just coming out in overnight, but we saw New York Times reporting last night that Johnson & Johnson has had to delay millions of vaccine doses, like 15 million doses, from being shipped because someone in Baltimore, like Humanair, accidentally started conflating ingredients. I mean, what does that mean? What effect could it have?
Well, I think that, first of all, when people hear that headline, they should be reassured that, again, this is an example that safety corners will not be cut despite the pace and the effort and the magnitude of the scale of this vaccination campaign. So they do catch these kind of errors, just like we have food recalls in this country. This is a perfect example. These vaccines are manufactured, and then they have to be inspected. So in inspection, they can pick up things like this. So to me, this is encouraging news that the system works.
Right. In terms of vaccines getting rolled out, like, nightmare scenario for Johnson & Johnson. But in terms of safety, perhaps a sign that things are working, at least as planned. No comment from the FDA or other federal agencies here, but Johnson & Johnson did release a statement last night confirming this happened, also pointing out that no vaccines went out into the public that were compromised. That's a big deal to point out, that this was part of the testing stage before they ever go off the production line. So the J&J vaccines out there right now, they're good to go. They also promise that they will meet their goal of 100 million doses by the middle of the year, but a big setback in the meantime. Dr. Jennifer Ashton, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Sports fans will tell you, April is one of the best months of them all. In the span of the next week, we're about to see baseball's opening day, that's today, the Final Four this weekend, college basketball, and then the Masters Golf Tournament. Like, you can smell the freshly cut grass from here. And each of these events gets millions of eyeballs at a time and therefore rakes in exponentially more dollars.
From the first four to the final four!
And yet, out of those three huge events, only in two of them Do the athletes get paid for their time?
This is the first NCAA case before the Supreme Court in over 35 years.
They want to put a line between what they do and what professional sports is. And so far, the Supreme Court has allowed the NCAA to set that standard.
Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard a case that could determine the future of college sports. And some observers said just based on the reactions of the justices on this teleconference, this was a slam dunk for athletes. So let's go to ABC senior Washington reporter Devin Dwyer. Devin, just walk us through this case, first of all.
Hey, Brad, this is a case that gets to the heart of what it means to be an amateur college athlete. There's been a debate in this country for years over whether those college athletes should get paid, how much benefit they should get financially from the schools for performing in these sports. As you said there, the schools, of course, make billions of dollars in media deals to showcase these tournaments and the like. And a group of players a few years ago sued the NCAA over limits that they put on students' ability to recoup education-related expenses, basically education-related compensation from the schools to play on their teams. So these are things like limits on the number of computers, school supplies, musical instruments, paid internships, travel per diems.
Oh, I was going to say, like, they get a lot of them are on scholarships, so I was thinking, like, that money's taken care of there.
Yeah, they get full tuition, they can get room and board, they can get basically up to a cap. They can't be paid for their athletic skill, and that's how the NCAA defines amateurism. And so they were sued by these players at the court.
Well, about 2 years ago, a judge in California named Claudia Wilkin ruled that the NCAA could no longer place any limits on the type of education-related benefits that schools can give to their athletes. The NCAA appealed this decision, saying that they're worried that that creates a slippery slope, that this will become a thinly veiled way for schools to pay athletes directly for their athletic performance.
The NCAA says in order to be competitive, in order to have a product that people want to view, they need to retain an amateur quality, which means they're not paid for their performance.
For more than 100 years, the distinct character of college sports has been that it's played by students who are amateurs, which is to say that they are not paid for their play.
But the players are challenging that, say this is an unreasonable restraint on trade. They have a special skill. They should be able to monetize it.
There's no justification for limiting education-related benefits, but say, after all, what the consumers and others care about is they be students.
And so before the justices yesterday, this battle played out in real time, just as the tournament is going on.
Wait, so you're saying one of the arguments from the NCAA is people like seeing the scrappy young kids. They like seeing these they like seeing unpaid people do work, and we make money off that, and no one would make money if the kids were paid. Is that... Like, how does that go over with the justices?
Yeah, this is a case about antitrust law, Brad, and I'll spare you the details on the intricacies of it. But basically, the league is saying they're not being anti-competitive by trying to tie the hands of these players. They're saying they're actually being pro-competitive. They want to give viewers, Americans, a choice. Watch college sports or watch pro sports.
They have imposed a regime in which student athletes can be paid large sums of money on account of their athletic performance, which does not distinguish college from professional sports.
And they argue that there's a reason why college sports are special, and that's because these players are students. They're students, and they're not paid to play.
Our own view is if you allow them to be paid, they will be spending even more time on their athletics and devoting even less attention to academics.
Well, it just strikes me as odd that the coaches' salaries have ballooned, and they're in the amateur ranks, as are the players.
And it was striking, Brad, to hear the justices yesterday basically poke holes in the NCAA's argument for over an hour on the left and the right.
I mean, a great deal has changed since 100 years ago in the way that student athletes are treated.
This would allow the players to receive $6,000 a year, as if that were some exorbitant amount when the TV contracts are in the billions.
Samuel Alito even went so far as to voice empathy for the players, saying, look, these players face hard conditions.
They face training requirements that leave little time or energy for study.
Many of them face, graduation rates well below the national average.
Division I athletes graduate at higher rates than students who are not athletes.
Yeah, that's
and have better outcomes following graduation.
Yeah, the athletes and the crew and fencing, but for the powerhouse basketball and football programs, it's different. Let me see.
And so there was some pushback on the other side. We kept hearing the NCAA lawyer pushing back, saying if this rule is struck down, if the lower court decisions are upheld, we could see bidding wars between the rich schools trying to lure players to their teams over who can provide more benefits, who can provide more financial incentives to get them there.
There is no doubt that what has happened with respect to the pay of college coaches and other professionals will happen if conferences or individual schools are permitted to remove these restrictions.
But over and over again, Brad, the justices kept coming back to the fact that these players are human beings. They've got a skill. They should be able to get a slice of the pie.
The schools are conspiring with competitors, agreeing with competitors, I'll say that, to pay no salaries to the workers who are making the schools billions of dollars on the theory that consumers want the schools to pay their workers nothing. And that just seems entirely circular and even somewhat disturbing.
Well, and it's interesting because, like you said, liberals and conservatives. Yeah, the liberals who you'd expect to be like workers' rights, but then the conservatives are like, sure, we're all about free enterprise, but like not paying anyone anything. Like that's a much different version of free enterprise.
Exactly. And there was recognition that the train is leaving the station on this issue already, Brad.
In defiance of the NCAA, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed the Fair Pay for Play Act in a bill signing ceremony hosted by LeBron James on his HBO show, The Shop.
You know, I always tell you part of the reason why I went to the NBA is to get my mom out of the situation that she was in. I couldn't have done that if I would have slept on a college campus.
A number of states, California first among them, have already started to pass laws proactively ruling that players at colleges and universities in their states should be allowed to monetize their name, image, and likeness as an athlete in college. So those sorts of changes are already underway. The NCAA is sort of reluctantly having to come around to them, but they were trying to draw the line here on this issue of education-related compensation, and we'll see how the court comes out on that.
Yeah, and again, if there's a state that says, hey, you can make money in our state and not in others, well, guess where the good athletes are going to go. Like you said, the train might be leaving the station. All right, Devin Dwyer, fascinating stuff. Thank you.
Thanks, Brett.
Next up on Start Here, hey, the drug cartels have caused people to flee your country. Oh, what's that? You've allegedly been working with the drug cartels? The awkward conversations in Central America after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
At this point, we've seen a ton of video of people arriving at the southern border. We've spoken to a ton of people crossing the border. But yesterday, we saw something that horrified even my colleagues who've been covering immigration for years.
Immediately when we found out that footage existed, I remember giving direction and letting the staff know,
This is our number one priority.
It's a silent surveillance video from Customs and Border Patrol. It's dark, but using night vision, you can see this figure, what looks like a man, climbing a 14-foot-high border wall. He straddles it, and he grabs something from the other side. It's a small child, a toddler. He holds the kid by the arm. He leans down towards the ground, dangling this child, who's still probably 5 feet above dirt and rocks. And the man lets go. The child falls and lies on the ground as another child is dropped right next to it. And that's when you see this man toss something on the ground next to them, maybe supplies, and then hop back down onto the Mexico side. This is when you realize that this man, most likely a smuggler, is leaving these children alone by themselves in the desert, hoping that American authorities will find them.
They do have a mom in the United States, and our agents have already made contact with their mother.
Which they did. We now know these children were from Ecuador. They're 3 and 5 years old.
The idea that I'm going to say, which I would never do, that if an unaccompanied child ends up at the border, we're just going to let him starve to death and stay on the other side. No previous administration did that either, except Trump. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
President Biden has said under no circumstances will he just drop unaccompanied minors back in Mexico, leading to the big question of how to take care of all the children who are arriving right now. But he also says the bigger overarching goal here is to address the issues creating these smuggling markets in the first place, which poses a big dilemma for the Biden administration because what do you do when the leader of one of these countries, their president, is allegedly working in tandem with drug lords? Let's go to ABC's Victoria Mole Ramirez. She's been examining the country of Honduras. And Victoria, why has the president of Honduras, 1,000 miles away, created such a conundrum for the U.S.?
It's a multi-layered situation. I think the short answer I can give you is the reason why they're so unique compared to El Salvador or Guatemala.
We're going to turn next, though, to Central America, because the president of Honduras has just been implicated in a drug trafficking scandal.
It's because of the fact that our federal government has stated that the current sitting president of Honduras has accepted millions of dollars in bribes from drug traffickers and has even helped perpetuate the drug trade in Honduras of cocaine that eventually makes its way up to the United States.
So that's not like some allegations in Honduras. You're saying that the U.S. government official, like that's the official record here.
The Department of Justice has said that the president of Honduras not only accepted bribes, but also his goal was to, quote, stick cocaine up the nose of the gringos.
The major victory, the arrest of a Mexican drug lord whose reach was far and wide. He was cruel, unforgiving in his ways, and one of the main destinations for his drug trade, the United States.
The U.S. government started revealing a lot of this information because a lot of it is actually tied to the arrest of El Chapo.
There he is, the man known as El Chapo, a.k.a. Shorty, who runs the world's largest drug cartel.
The moment El Chapo got arrested, it kind of created a trickle effect in terms of the drug traffickers, one of those being the brother of the current sitting president of Honduras, Tony Hernandez. U.S. prosecutors have said that the Honduran president, the current Honduran president, actually received $1 million from El Chapo via his brother. And as a matter of fact, this week in the Southern District of New York, our federal court, the brother of Juan Orlando Hernandez was sentenced to life in prison plus 30 years for his involvement in the drug trade. Now, President Juan Orlando Hernandez himself has not been charged in the U.S. He's also denied committing any crime. And the State Department hasn't really weighed in one way or the other, so you can see how tricky this is for the U.S.
Okay, so wow, and then I'm thinking about immigration. So hypothetically, if you got a president who has empowered drug cartels to take over neighborhoods, to take over industries, we've seen what happens when organized crime runs a country. Like, people fear for their lives, there are hits put out on people, families flee. And our response here in the U.S. is, hey, we should talk to the president over there. Maybe he's got the answer to this immigration problem. Well, these families sound like they would say, like, he's directly responsible for why they're here in the first place.
Absolutely. And, you know, Brad, you and I talked about this 2 years ago when I was on the ground in Honduras reporting for my fellowship with the International Women's Media Foundation. Time and time again, when I would talk to people who were protesting in the streets, who were calling on this president to resign, they would tell me time and time again that the bigger issue that the country faced was corruption, because the gangs would not be allowed to thrive if their government was not a corrupt one.
This is a part of town known for gang activity, but it's 10 o'clock in the morning, and this is a murder that happened in broad daylight out in the open. You can see the body is sort of half covered right there.
So the people of Honduras are kind of at a place in life where they feel we are surrounded by violence.
Out of that catastrophic hurricane.
We were hit by hurricanes.
Iota slamming into hard-hit Central America as a powerful Category 4 storm, just 15 miles from where Ada devastated the area earlier this month.
And our president, according to the U.S. federal court system, accepted drug bribes and trafficked drugs.
Entonces es una, your family left Honduras.
So what hope is left? The hope to head north.
So what does Biden do? So, like, that sounds horrible. What is Biden going to do in the next several weeks or months?
I think President Biden, along with Vice President Harris, both have a very delicate dance.
In addition to that, there's about five other major things she's handling. But I've asked her, the VP today, because she's the most qualified person to do it, to lead our efforts with Mexico and the Northern Triangle.
I think Vice President Harris definitely has an upper hand in the way she can talk to particularly Juan Orlando because of her background as a federal prosecutor.
We also understand that we will enforce the law and that we also, because we can chew gum and walk at the same time, must address the root causes.
Doesn't mean she knows anything about the case or not. But I think what does work in favor of the Biden administration is that they have the luxury of playing a shorter game because this president's term is up in November. So keep it cool for now and just tiptoe around the situation as much as possible.
Which is tough to do when you're talking about six more months of this exact kind of migration that is happening right now. All right, Victoria Mole Ramirez, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And one last thing. In the music world, there are reliable hit makers, artists who seemingly every time they write a song, don't miss. But how many times have they actually written that song?
There is a kind of a slogan in the industry called write a word, get a third.
That is ABC's Andrea Dresdale, who covers the music industry, and she's talking about songwriting royalties.
Royalties are the money that you earn from a song is already split many different ways between publishing, mechanical royalties, performance royalties.
Basically, if you perform a hit song, you get a cut of that profit. That's your performance royalty. If you write it, you get a different cut. But what if two people write it? Well, then they split it. And often, you'll see a big-name star getting the performance royalties along with that songwriting royalty, even if the artist wasn't a huge part of that process. Hence the phrase,
write a word, get a third, which is basically when an artist doesn't really do anything but, like, maybe change one word and then, you know, ask for songwriting credit. But the very worst example of this is when an artist does nothing for a song but demands songwriting credit or has their people demand songwriting credit. Yes, I'm a big star. I'll record your song, little songwriter, but you're going to have to give me money on it.
Well, this week, a group of songwriters, people you might not know but are a big deal in the music world, put out a letter.
Essentially, it is asking all the biggest songwriters in the industry, even the non-big ones, anybody, any songwriters who are in the music industry today, to sign their names, to join a pact, to make a pact that they will no longer give up some of their royalties.
And some of these writers work with big music stars. Andrea says this weird tension has been building really since the days of Elvis Presley.
You were always on my mind.
Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker, always made it a practice whereby if Elvis was going to record a songwriter's song, he would immediately have to give him 50% of the publishing. And a famous example of where this didn't work was in 1974 when Dolly Parton wrote I Will Always Love You. It was a number one hit on the country charts. And Elvis said, well, I want to record this song. And Dolly's like, that's awesome. Elvis wants to record my song. She was so thrilled. But then Colonel Tom Parker said, well, you know, we get 50% of the publishing. And she's like, well, I can't give it to you. And he's like, well, then we're not doing the song. And she felt really bad and she cried about it. But she has a famous quote. I think she says, then when Whitney Houston recorded the song, she made enough money to buy Graceland.
And that's the thing. If you write a big song, you can make serious bank. But these days, big labels bring in 5, 6, 7 songwriters in on a hit. So songwriters' money is more and more diluted, which is why some insiders see this letter and its claims of pop star bullying as a turning point. Well, so is this going to work, Andrea? Like, does this letter campaign actually do anything?
I don't know. I guess it all depends on whether or not the artists will collectively band together and refuse. But sometimes I think the artists at this point in time, in this point in music history, might need the songwriters more than the artists. It all depends.
So next time you stream a single, maybe Google the credits. And remember, there are lots of people involved in a bop. Those songwriting controversies, they still slap. So does, like, anything that Dolly Parton touches just never gets old. Hey, if you're grooving to this show, remember, leave us a rating and review. It really, truly helps us out. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.